He could hear her breathing again. He turned the volume all the way up and lay back in the straps, waiting to be crushed. Alex didn't disappoint him.
1 minute,
Ade said, her voice loud enough to distort through his helmet speakers. Holden didn't turn the volume down. Her voice was admirably calm as she called out the impact countdown.
30 seconds.
Holden wanted desperately to talk, to say something comforting, to make ludicrous and untrue assertions of love. The giant, standing on his chest, just laughed with the deep rumble of their fusion torch.
10 seconds.
Get ready to kill the reactor and play dead after the torpedoes hit. If we're not a threat, they won't hit us again, McDowell said.
5, Ade said. 4. 3, 2, 1.
The Canterbury shuddered, and the monitor went white. Ade took one sharp intake of breath, which cut off as the radio broke up. The static squeal almost ruptured Holden's eardrums. He chinned the volume down and clicked his radio at Alex. The thrust suddenly dropped to a tolerable 2G, and all the ship's sensors flared into overload. A brilliant light poured through the small airlock porthole.
Report, Alex, report. What happened? Holden yelled.
My God. They nuked her. They nuked the cant,
Alex said, his voice low and dazed.
What's her status? Give me a report on the Canterbury. I have 0 sensors down here. Everything's just gone white.
There was a long pause. Then Alex said,
I have 0 sensors up here too, boss. But I can give you a status on the cant. I can see her.
See her? From here?
Yeah.
She's a cloud of vapor the size of Olympus Mons.
She's gone, boss.
She's gone.
That can't be right, Holden's mind protested. That doesn't happen. Pirates don't nuke water haulers. No one wins. No one gets paid. And if you just want to murder 50 people, walking into a restaurant with a machine gun is a lot easier. He wanted to shout it, scream at Alex that he was wrong, but he had to keep it together. I'm the old man now.
All right. New mission, Alex. Now we're witnesses to murder. Get us back to that asteroid. I'll start compiling a broadcast. Wake everyone up. They need to know, Holden said. I'm rebooting the sensor package.
He methodically shut down the sensors and their software, waited 2 minutes, then slowly brought them back online. His hands were shaking. He was nauseated. His body felt like he was operating his flesh from a distance, and he didn't know how much was the juice and how much was shock. The sensors came back up. Like any other ship that flew the space lanes, the night was hardened against radiation. You couldn't get anywhere near Jupiter's massive radiation belt unless you were. But Holden doubted the ship's designers had 6 nuclear weapons going off nearby in mind when they'd created the specs. They'd gotten lucky. Vacuum might protect them from an electromagnetic pulse, but the blast radiation could still have fried every sensor the ship had. Once the array came back up, he scanned the space where the Canterbury had been. There was nothing larger than a softball. He switched over to the ship that killed it, which was flying off sunward at a leisurely 1G. Heat bloomed in Holden's chest. He wasn't scared. Aneurysm-inducing rage made his temples pound and his fists squeeze until his tendons hurt. He flipped on the comms and aimed a tight beam at the retreating ship.
This message is to whoever ordered the destruction of the Canterbury, the civilian ice freighter that you just blew into gas. You don't just get to fly away, you murderous son of a bitch.
I don't care what your reasons are, but you just killed 50 friends of mine. You need to know who they were. I am sending to you the name and photograph of everyone who just died in that ship. Take a good look at what you did. Think about that while I work on finding out who you are. He closed the voice channel, pulled up the Canterbury's personnel files, and began transmitting the crew dossiers to the other ship. What are you doing? Asked Naomi from behind him, not from his helmet speakers. She was standing there with her helmet off. Sweat plastered her thick black hair to her head and neck. Her face was unreadable. Holden took off his helmet. I'm showing them the Canterbury was a real place where real people lived. People with names and families, he said, the juice making his voice less steady than he would have liked. If there's something resembling a human being giving the orders on that ship, I hope it haunts him right up to the day they put him in the recycler for murder. I don't think they appreciate it, Naomi said, pointing at the panel behind him. The enemy ship was now painting them with its targeting laser. Holden held his breath. No torpedoes launched, and after a few seconds, the stealth ship turned off its laser, and the engine flared as it scooted off at high G. He heard Naomi let out a shuddering breath. So, the Canterbury's gone? Naomi asked. Holden nodded.
Fuck me sideways, said Amos.
Amos and Shed stood together at the crew ladder. Amos's face was mottled red and white, and his big hands clenched and unclenched. Shed collapsed to his knees, slamming against the deck in the heavy 2G thrust. He didn't cry. He just looked at Holden and said, Cameron's never going to get that arm, I guess. Then buried his head in his hands and shook. Slow down, Alex. No need to run now, Holden said into the comm. The ship slowly dropped to 1G. What now, Captain? Naomi said, looking at him hard. You're in charge now. Act like it, she thought. Blowing them out of the sky would be my first choice, but since we don't have the weapons, follow them. Keep our eyes on them until we know where they're going. Expose them to everyone, Holden replied.
Fucking A, said Amos loudly.
Amos, Naomi said over her shoulder, take Shed below and get him into a couch. If you need to, give him something to put him to sleep.
You got it, boss.
Amos put a thick arm around Shed's waist and took him below. When he was gone, Naomi turned back to Holden. No, sir. We are not chasing that ship. We are going to call for help and then go wherever the help tells us to go. Holden started. Yes, you're in charge. That makes me XO, and it's the XO's job to tell the captain when he's being an idiot. You're being an idiot, sir. You already tried to goad them into killing us with that broadcast. Now you want to chase them? And what will you do if they let you catch them? Broadcast another emotional plea? Naomi said, moving closer to him. You are going to get the remaining 4 members of your crew to safety, and that's all. When we're safe, you can go on your crusade. Sir. Holden unbuckled the straps on his couch and stood up. The juice was starting to burn out, leaving his body spent and sickened. Naomi lifted her chin and didn't back up. Glad you're with me, Naomi, he said. Go see to the crew. McDowell gave me one last order. Naomi looked him over critically. He could see her distrust. He didn't defend himself. He just waited until she was done. She nodded at him once and climbed down the ladder to the deck below. Once she was gone, he worked methodically, putting together a broadcast package that included all the sensor data from the Canterbury and the night. Alex climbed down from the cockpit and sat down heavily in the next chair.
"You know, Captain, I've been thinking," he said. His voice had the same post-juice shakes as Holden's own.
Holden bit back his irritation at the interruption and said,
"What about?" "That stealth ship."
Holden turned away from his work.
"Tell me." "So, I don't know any pirates that have shit like that."
"Go on."
"In fact, the only time I've seen tech like that was back when I was in the Navy," Alex said. "We were working on ships with energy-absorbing skins and internal heat sinks. More of a strategic weapon than a tactical one. You can't hide an active drive, but if you can get into position and shut the drive down, store all your waste heat internally, you can hide yourself pretty good. Add in the energy-absorbing skin, and radar, lidar, and passive sensors don't pick you up. Plus, pretty tough to get nuclear torpedoes outside of the military."
"You're saying the Martian Navy did this?" Alex took a long, shuddering breath.
"If we had it, you know the Earthers were working on it too," he said.
They looked at each other across the narrow space, the implications heavier than a 10G burn. Holden pulled the transmitter and battery they'd recovered from the scopuli out of the thigh pocket of his suit. He started pulling it apart, looking for a stamp or an insignia. Alex watched, quiet for once. The transmitter was generic. It could have come from the radio room of any ship in the solar system. The battery was a nondescript gray block. Alex reached out and Holden handed it to him. Alex pried off the gray plastic cover and flipped the metal battery around in his hands. Without saying a word, he held the bottom up to Holden's face. Stamped in the black metal on the bottom of the battery was a serial number that began with the letters MCRN. Martian Congressional Republic Navy. The radio was set to broadcast on full power. The data package was ready to transmit. Holden stood in front of the camera, leaning a little forward.
"My name is James Holden," he said. "And my ship, the Canterbury, was just destroyed by a warship with stealth technology and what appear to be parts stamped with Martian Navy serial numbers. Data stream to follow."
Chapter 6. Miller. The cart sped through the tunnel, siren masking the whine of motors. Behind them, they left curious civilians and the scent of overheated bearings. Miller leaned forward in his seat, willing the cart to go faster. They were three levels, maybe 4 kilometers from the station house.
"Okay," Havelock said. "I'm sorry, but I'm missing something here."
"What?" Miller said. He meant, "What are you yammering about?" Havelock took it as, "What are you missing?" "A water hauler, millions of clicks from here, got vaporized. Why are we going on full alert? Our cisterns will last months without even going on rationing. There are a lot of other haulers out there. Why is this a crisis?"
Miller turned and looked at his partner straight on. The small, stocky build. The thick bones from a childhood in full G. Just like the asshole in the transmission. They didn't understand. If Havelock had been in this James Holden's place, he might have done the same stupid, irresponsible, idiotic bullshit. For the space of a breath, they weren't security anymore. They weren't partners. They were a belter and an earther. Miller looked away before Havelock could see the change in his eyes.
"That prick Holden? The one in the broadcast?" Miller said.
He just declared war on Mars for us.
The cart swerved and bobbed, its internal computer adjusting for some virtual hiccup in the traffic flow half a kilometer ahead.
Havelock shifted, grabbing for the support strut. They hit a ramp up to the next level, civilians on foot making a path for them.
You grew up where the waters may be dirty, but it falls out of the sky for you, Miller said. The air is filthy, but it's not going away if your door seals fail. It's not like that out here.
But we're not on the hauler. We don't need the ice. We aren't under threat, Havelock said.
Miller sighed, rubbing his eyes with thumb and knuckle until ghosts of false color bloomed.
When I was homicide, Miller said, there was this guy, property management specialist working a contract out of Luna. Someone burned half his skin off and dropped him out an airlock. Turned out he was responsible for maintenance on 60 holes up on level 30. Lousy neighborhood. He'd been cutting corners. Hadn't replaced the air filters in 3 months. There was mold growing in 3 of the units.
And you know what we found after that?
What? Havelock asked. Not a goddamn thing. Because we stopped looking. Some people need to die. And he was one. And the next guy that took the job cleaned the ducting and swapped the filters on schedule. That's what it's like in the belt. Anyone who came out here and didn't put environmental systems above everything else died young. All us still out here are the ones that cared.
Selective effect, Havelock said.
You're seriously arguing in favor of selective effect? I never thought I'd hear that shit coming out of you.
What's that?
Racist propaganda bullshit, Havelock said. It's the one that says the difference in environment has changed the belters so much that instead of just being a bunch of skinny obsessive compulsives, they aren't really human anymore.
I'm not saying that, Miller said, suspecting that it was exactly what he was saying.
It's just that belters don't take the long view when you screw with basic resources. That water was future air, propellant mass, and potables for us. We have no sense of humor about that shit.
The cart hit a ramp of metalwork grate. The lower level fell away below them. Havelock was silent.
This Holden guy didn't say it was Mars, just that they found a Martian battery. You think people are going to declare war?
Havelock said.
Just on the basis of this one guy's pictures of a battery?
The ones that wait to get the whole story aren't our problem.
At least, not tonight, he thought.
Once the whole story gets out, we'll see where we stand.
The station house was somewhere between one half and three quarters full. Security men stood in clumps, nodding to each other, eyes narrow and jaws tight. One of the vice cops laughed at something, his amusement loud, forced, smelling of fear.
Miller saw the change in Havelock as they walked across the common area to their desks. Havelock had been able to put Miller's reaction down to one man's being oversensitive. A whole room, though. A whole station house. By the time they reached their chairs, Havelock's eyes were wide.
Captain Shadid came in. The bleary look was gone. Her hair was pulled back. Her uniform, crisp and professional. Her voice as calm as a surgeon in a battlefield hospital. She stepped up on the first desk she came to, improvising a pulpit.
"Ladies and gentlemen," she said, "you've seen the transmission. Any questions?"
"Who let that fucking earther near a radio?"
someone shouted.
Miller saw Havelock laugh along with the crowd, but it didn't reach his eyes. Shadid scowled, and the crowd quieted.
"Here's the situation," she said. "No way we can control this information. It was broadcast everywhere. We have 5 sites on the internal network that have been mirroring it.
and we have to assume it's public knowledge starting 10 minutes ago. Our job now is to keep the rioting to a minimum and ensure station integrity around the port. Station houses 50 and 213 are helping on it too. The Port Authority has released all the ships with Interplanet Registry. That doesn't mean they're all gone. They still have to round up their crews. But it does mean they're going.
The government offices? Miller said, loud enough to carry.
Not our problem, thank God, Shadid said. They have infrastructure in place. Blast doors are already down and sealed. They've broken off from the main environmental systems, so we aren't even breathing their air right now.
Well, that's a relief, Yevgeny said from the cluster of homicide detectives.
Now, the bad news, Shadid said. Miller heard the silence of 150 cops holding their breath. We've got 80 known OPA agents on the station. They're all employed and legal. And you know this is the kind of thing they've been waiting for. We have an order from the governor that we're not going to do any proactive detention. No one gets arrested until they do something.
Angry voices rose in chorus.
Who does he think he is? Someone called from the back. Shadid snapped at the comment like a shark. The governor is the one who contracted with us to keep this station in working order, Shadid said. We'll follow his directives.
In his peripheral vision, Miller saw Havelock nod. He wondered what the governor thought of the question of Belter independence. Maybe the OPA weren't the only ones who'd been waiting for something like this to happen. Shadid went on, outlining the security response they were permitted. Miller listened with half an ear. So lost in speculating on the politics behind the situation, he almost missed it when Shadid called his name.
Miller will take the second team to the port level and cover sectors 13 through 24. Kasagawa, team 3, 25 through 36, and so on. That's 20 men apiece except for Miller.
I can make it with 19, Miller said. Then quietly to Havelock. You're sitting this one out, partner. Having an Earther with a gun out there isn't going to make things better.
Yeah, Havelock said. Saw that coming. Okay, Shadid said. You all know the drill. Let's move.
Miller rounded up his riot squad. All the faces were familiar. All men and women he'd worked with over his years in security. He organized them in his mind with a nearly automatic efficiency. Brown and Gelbfish both had SWAT experience, so they would lead the wings if it came to crowd control. Aberforth had 3 write-ups for excessive violence since her kid had been busted for drug running on Ganymede, so she was second string. She could work out her anger management issues another time. Around the station house, he heard the other squad commanders making similar decisions.
Okay, Miller said, let's suit up.
They moved away in a group, heading for the equipment bay. Miller paused. Havelock remained leaning against his desk, arms folded, eyes locked on the middle distance. Miller was torn between sympathy for the man and impatience. It was hard being on the team, but not on the team. On the other hand, what the hell had he expected, taking a contract in the belt? Havelock looked up, meeting Miller's gaze. They nodded to each other. Miller was the first to turn away. The equipment bay was part warehouse, part bank vault, designed by someone more concerned with conserving space than getting things out efficiently. The lights, recessed white LEDs, gave the gray walls a sterile cast. Bare stone echoed every voice and footfall. Banks of ammunition and firearms, evidence bags and test panels, spare servers and replacement uniforms lined the walls and filled most of the interior space. The riot gear was in a side room, in gray steel lockers with high-security electronic locks. The standard outfit consisted of high-impact plastic shields, electric batons, shin guards, bullet-resistant chest and thigh armor,
and helmets with reinforced face guards. All of it designed to make a handful of station security into an intimidating, inhuman force. Miller keyed in his access code. The seals released. The lockers opened.
Well, Miller said conversationally, fuck me.
The lockers were empty. Gray coffins with the corpses all gone. Across the room, he heard one of the other squads shouting in outrage. Miller systematically opened every riot control locker he could get to. All of them were the same. Shadid appeared at his side, her face pale with rage.
What's Plan B? Miller asked.
Shadid spat on the floor, then closed her eyes. They shifted under her lids like she was dreaming. Two long breaths later, they opened.
Check the SWAT lockers. There should be enough in there to outfit two people in each squad.
Snipers? Miller said.
You have a better idea, detective?
Shadid said, leaning on the last word. Miller raised his hands in surrender. Riot gear was meant to intimidate and control. SWAT gear was made to kill with the greatest efficiency possible. Seemed their mandate had just changed. On any given day, 1,000 ships might be docked on Ceres Station, and activity there rarely slowed and never stopped. Each sector could accommodate 20 ships, the traffic of humanity and cargo, transport vans, mezzo cranes, and industrial forklifts. And his squad was responsible for 20 sectors. The air stank of refrigerant and oil. The gravity was slightly above 0.3G, station spin alone lending the place a sense of oppression and danger. Miller didn't like the port. Having vacuum so close under his feet made him nervous. Passing the dock workers and transport crews, he didn't know whether to scowl or smile. He was here to scare people into behaving, and also to reassure them that everything was under control. After the first three sectors, he settled on the smile. It was the kind of lie he was better at. They had just reached the junction of sectors 19 and 20 when they heard screaming. Miller pulled his hand terminal out of his pocket, connected to the central surveillance network, and called up the security camera array. It took a few seconds to find it, a mob of 50 or 60 civilians stretching almost all the way across the tunnel, traffic blocked on both sides. There were weapons being waved overheads, knives, clubs, at least two pistols, fists pumped in the air. And at the center of the crowd, a huge, shirtless man was beating someone to death.
Showtime. Miller said, waving his squad forward at a run.
He was still 100 meters from the turn that would take them to the clot of human violence when he saw the shirtless man knock his victim to the ground, then stomp on her neck. The head twisted sideways at an angle that didn't leave any question. Miller slowed his team to a brisk walk. Arresting the murderer while surrounded by a crowd of his friends would be tough enough without being winded. There was blood in the water now. Miller could sense it. The mob was going to turn out, to the station, to the ships. If the people started joining the chaos, what path would it be likely to take? There was a brothel, one level up from there, and half a kilometer anti-spinward that catered to inner planet types. The tariff inspector for Sector 21 was married to a girl from Luna, and had bragged about it maybe once too often. There were too many targets, Miller thought, even as he motioned his snipers to spread out. He was trying to reason with a fire. Stop it here, and no one else got killed. In his imagination, Candace crossed her arms and said, "What's Plan B?" The outer edge of the mob raised the alarm well before Miller reached it. The surge of bodies and threat shifted. Miller tipped back his hat. Men, women, dark skin, pale, golden brown, and all with the long, thin build of belters, all with the square-mouthed, angry gape of chimpanzees at war.
"Let me take a couple of them down, sir," Gelbfish said from his terminal. "Put the fear of God into them."
"We'll get there," Miller said, smiling at the angry mob. "We'll get there."
The face he expected floated to the front, shirtless. The big man, blood covering his hands and splattered on his cheek. The seed crystal of the riot.
"That one?" Gelbfish asked, and Miller knew that a tiny infrared dot was painting shirtless's forehead even as he glowered at Miller and the uniforms behind him.
"No," Miller said. "That'll only set the rest of them off."
"So what do we do?" Brown said.
It was a hell of a question.
"Sir," Gelbfish said, "the big fucker's got an OPA tattoo on his left shoulder."
"Well," Miller said, "if you do have to shoot him, start there."
He stepped forward, tying his terminal into the local system, overriding the alert. When he spoke, his voice boomed from the overhead speakers.
"This is Detective Miller. Unless you all want to be locked up as accessories to murder, I suggest you disperse now."
Muting the microphone in his terminal, he said to Shirtless,
"Not you, big fella. Move a muscle and we shoot you."
Someone in the crowd threw a wrench, the silver metal arcing low through the air toward Miller's head. He almost stepped out of the way, but the handle caught him across the ear. His head filled with the deep sound of bells, and the wet of blood tracked down his neck.
"Hold fire," Miller shouted. "Hold your fire."
The crowd laughed, as if he'd been talking to them. Idiots. Shirtless, emboldened, strode forward. The steroids had distended his thighs so badly that he waddled. Miller turned the mic on his terminal back on. If the crowd was watching them face each other down, they weren't breaking things. It wasn't spreading. Not yet.
"So, friend, you only kick helpless people to death, or can anybody join in?"
Miller asked, his voice conversational, but echoing out of the dock speakers like a pronouncement from God.
"The fuck you barking, Earth dog?" Shirtless said.
"Earth?"
Miller said, chuckling.
"I look like I grew up in a gravity well to you? I was born on this rock." "Innes kibble, you bitch," Shirtless said. "You de dog."
"You think?"
"Fucking dway,"
Shirtless said. "Fucking true." He flexed his pectorals. Miller suppressed the urge to laugh.
"So, killing that poor bastard was for the good of the station?" Miller said. "The good of the belt? Don't be a chump, kid. They're playing you. They want you to act like a bunch of stupid riot boys, so they have a reason to shut this place down."
"Schrauben Sie die Weibchen,"
Shirtless said in belter-inflected gutter German, leaning forward.
"Okay, second time I've been called a bitch," Miller thought. "Kneecap him," Miller said.
Shirtless's legs blew out in twin sprays of crimson, and he went down howling. Miller walked past his writhing body, stepping toward the mob.
"You're taking orders from this pendejo?" he said. "Listen to me, we all know what's coming. We know dance starting now like pow, right? They fuck to agua, and we all know the answer. Out in airlock, no?"
He could see it in their faces. The sudden fear of the snipers, then the confusion. He pressed on, not giving them time to think. He switched back to the lower-level lingo, the language of education, authority.
"You know what Mars wants? They want you doing this. They want this piece of shit here to make sure that everyone looks at belters and thinks we're a bunch of psychopaths who tear up their own station. They want to tell themselves we're just like them. Well, we aren't. We're belters, and we take care of our own."
He picked a man at the edge of the mob, not as pumped as shirtless, but big. He had an OPA split circle on his arm.
"You," Miller said. "You want to fight for the belt?"
"Dwe," the man said.
"I bet you do. He did too," Miller said, jerking a thumb back at shirtless. "But now he's a cripple, and he's going down for murder. So, we've already lost one, you see? They're turning us against each other. Can't let them do that. Every one of you I have to arrest, or cripple, or kill, that's one less we have when the day comes. And it's coming. But it's not now. You understand?"
The OPA man scowled. The mob drew back from him, making space. Miller could feel it like a current against him. It was shifting.
"Day's coming, hombre," the OPA man said. "You know your side?"
The tone was a threat, but there was no power behind it. Miller took a slow breath. It was over.
"Always the side of the angels," he said. "Why don't you all go back to work? Show's over here, and we've all got plenty that needs doing."
Momentum broken, the mob fell apart. First one and two peeling off from the edges, and then the whole knot untying itself at once. 5 minutes after Miller had arrived, the only signs that anything had happened were shirtless, mewling in a pool of his own blood, the wound on Miller's ear, and the body of the woman 50 good citizens had stood by and watched be beaten to death. She was short, and wearing the flight suit of a Martian freight line.
"Only one dead. Makes it a good night," Miller thought sourly.
He went to the fallen man. The OPA tattoo was smeared red. Miller knelt.
"Friend," he said, "you are under arrest for the murder of that lady over there, whoever the hell she is. You are not required to participate in questioning without the presence of an attorney or union representative. And if you so much as look at me wrong, I'll space you. Do we understand each other?"
From the look in the man's eyes, Miller knew they did. Chapter 7. Holden. Holden could drink coffee at half a G. Actually sit and hold a mug under his nose and let the aroma drift up. Sip it slowly and not burn his tongue. Drinking coffee was one of the activities that didn't make the transition to microgravity well, but at half a G, it was fine. So he sat and tried very hard to think about coffee and gravity in the silence of the night's tiny galley. Even the normally talkative Alex was quiet. Amos had set his big handgun on the table and was staring at it with frightening concentration. Shed was asleep. Naomi was sitting across the room, drinking tea and keeping one eye on the wall panel next to her. She'd routed ops to it. As long as he kept his mind on his coffee, he didn't have to think about Ade giving one last gasp of fear and then turning into a glowing vapor. Alex ruined it by speaking.
"At some point, we need to decide where we're going," he said.
Holden nodded, took a sip of his coffee, and closed his eyes. His muscles vibrated like plucked strings, and his peripheral vision was dappled with points of imaginary light. The first twinges of the post-juice crash were starting, and it was going to be a bad one. He wanted to enjoy these last few moments before the pain hit.
"He's right, Jim," Naomi said. "We can't just fly in a big circle at half a G forever."
Holden didn't open his eyes. The darkness behind his lids was bright and active and mildly nauseating.
"We aren't waiting forever," he said. "We're waiting 50 minutes for Saturn Station to call me back and tell me what to do with their ship. The Knight is still P&K property. We're still employees. You wanted me to call for help, I called for help. Now we are waiting to see what that looks like."
"Shouldn't we start flying towards Saturn Station then, boss?"
Amos asked, directing his question at Naomi. Alex snorted.
Not on the Knight's engine. Even if we had the fuel for that trip, which we don't, I don't want to sit in this can for the next 3 months, he said. No, if we're going somewhere, it's got to be the Belt or Jupiter. We're as close to exactly between them as you can get.
I vote we continue on to Ceres, Naomi said. P&K has offices there. We don't know anyone in the Jupiter complex. Without opening his eyes, Holden shook his head.
No, we wait for them to call us back.
Naomi made an exasperated sound. It was funny, he thought, how you could make someone's voice out from the smallest sounds, a cough or a sigh, or the little gasp right before she died. Holden sat up and opened his eyes. He placed his coffee mug on the table carefully, with hands that were starting to palsy.
I don't want to fly sunward to Ceres because that's the direction the torpedo ship went. And your point about chasing them is well taken, Naomi. I don't want to fly out to Jupiter because we only have the fuel for one trip, and once we fly in that direction for a while, we're locked in. We are sitting here and drinking coffee because I need to make a decision, and P&K gets a say in that decision. So we wait for them to answer, and then I decide.
Holden got up slowly, carefully, and began moving toward the crew ladder.
I'm going to crash for a few minutes. Let the worst of the shakes wear off. If P&K calls, let me know.
Holden popped sedative tabs, thin, bitter pills with an aftertaste like bread mold. But he didn't sleep. Over and over, McDowell placed a hand on his arm and called him Jim. Becca laughed and cursed like a sailor. Cameron bragged about his prowess on the ice. Ade gasped. Holden had flown the Ceres to Saturn circuit on the Canterbury 9 times. 2 round trips a year for almost 5 years. Most of the crew had been there the entire time. Flying on the Cant might be the bottom of the barrel, but that meant there was nowhere else to go. People stayed, made the ship their home. After the near-constant duty transfers of the Navy, he appreciated stability. Made it his home, too. McDowell said something he couldn't quite make out. The Cant groaned like she was under a hard burn. Ade smiled and winked at him. The worst leg cramp in history hit every muscle in his body at once. Holden bit down hard on his rubber mouthguard, screaming. The pain brought an oblivion that was almost a relief. His mind shut off, drowned out by the needs of his body. Fortunately or not, the drugs started to kick in. His muscles unknotted. His nerves stopped screaming, and consciousness returned like a reluctant schoolboy. His jaw ached as he pulled out the guard. He'd worn tooth marks in the rubber. In the dim, blue cabin light, he thought about the kind of man who followed an order to kill a civilian ship. He'd done some things in the Navy that had kept him awake nights. He'd followed some orders he vehemently disagreed with. But to lock on to a civilian ship with 50 people aboard and press the button that launched 6 nuclear weapons, he would have refused. If his commanding officer had insisted, he'd have declared it an illegal order and demanded that the executive officer take control of the ship and arrest the captain. They'd have had to shoot him to get him away from the weapon post. He'd known the sort of people who would have followed the order, though. He told himself that they were sociopaths and animals, no better than pirates who'd board your ship, strip your engine, and take your air. That they weren't human. But even as he nursed his hatred, drug-hazed rage offering its nihilistic comforts,
He couldn't believe they were idiots. The itch at the back of his head was still, why? What does anyone gain from killing an ice hauler? Who gets paid? Someone always gets paid. I'm going to find you. I'm going to find you and end you. But before I do, I'm going to make you explain. The second wave of pharmaceuticals exploded in his bloodstream. He was hot and limp, his veins filled with syrup. Just before the tabs finally knocked him out, Ade smiled and winked and blew away like dust. The comm beeped at him. Naomi's voice said, Jim, the PNK response finally came in. Want me to send it down there? Holden struggled to make sense of the words. Blinked. Something was wrong with his bunk. With the ship. Slowly, he remembered. Jim?
No, he said. I want to watch it up in ops with you. How long was I out?
3 hours, she said.
Jesus. They took their sweet time getting back to us, didn't they?
Holden rolled out of his couch and wiped off the crust that held his eyelashes together. He'd been weeping in his sleep. He told himself it was from the juice crash. The deep ache in his chest was only stressed cartilage. What were you doing for 3 hours before you called us back? He wondered. Naomi waited for him at the comm station, a man's face frozen mid-word on the screen in front of her. He seemed familiar. That isn't the operations manager.
Nope, it's the PNK legal counsel on Saturn Station.
The one who gave that speech after the crackdown on supply pilfering, Naomi said. Stealing from us is stealing from you. That one.
Lawyer, Holden said with a grimace. This is going to be bad news then.
Naomi restarted the message. The lawyer sprang into motion.
James Holden, this is Wallace Fitz calling from Saturn Station. We've received your request for help and your report of the incident. We've also received your broadcast accusing Mars of destroying the Canterbury. This was, to say the least, ill-advised. The Martian representative on Saturn Station was in my office not 5 minutes after your broadcast was received, and the MCR is quite upset by what they view as unfounded accusations of piracy by their government. To further investigate this matter, and to aid in discovering the true wrongdoers, if any, the MCRN is dispatching one of their ships from the Jupiter system to pick you up. The MCRN Doniger is the name of this vessel. Your orders from P&K are as follows. You will fly at best possible speed to the Jupiter system. You will cooperate fully with instructions given you by the MCRN Doniger or by any officer of the Martian Congressional Republic Navy. You will assist the MCRN in their investigation into the destruction of the Canterbury. You will refrain from any further broadcasting except to us or the Doniger. If you fail to follow these instructions from the company and from the government of Mars, your contract with P&K will be terminated, and you will be considered in illegal possession of a PNK shuttlecraft. We will then prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law. Wallace Fitz out.
Holden frowned at the monitor, then shook his head.
I never said Mars did it.
You sort of did, Naomi replied.
I didn't say anything that wasn't entirely factual and backed up by the data I transmitted, and I engaged in no speculation about those facts.
So, Naomi said, what do we do?
No fucking way, Amos said. No fucking way.
The galley was a small space. The five of them filled it uncomfortably. The gray laminate walls showed whorls of bright scrapes where mold had grown once and been cleaned off with microwaves and steel wool. Shed sat with his back against the wall, Naomi across the table.
Alex stood in the doorway. Amos had started pacing along the back, two fast paces, then a turn, before the lawyer had finished his first sentence.
"I'm not happy about it either, but that's the word from the Home Office," Holden said, pointing at the galley's display screen.
"Didn't mean to get you guys in trouble."
"No problem, Holden. I still think you did the right thing," Shed replied, running one hand through his limp blonde hair.
"So, what do you think the Martians will do with us?"
"I'm thinking pull our fucking toes off until Holden goes back on the radio and says it wasn't them," Amos said. "What in the holy hell is this? They attacked us, and now we're supposed to cooperate? They killed the captain."
"Amos," Holden said.
"Sorry, Holden. Captain," Amos said. "But Jesus wept, we're getting fucked here, and not the nice way. We're not gonna do this, are we?"
"I don't want to disappear into some Martian prison ship forever," Holden said. "The way I see it, we have two options. Either we go along with this, which is basically throwing ourselves on their mercy, or we run. Try to make it to the belt and hide."
"I'm voting for the belt," Naomi said, her arms crossed.
Amos raised a hand, seconding the motion. Shed slowly raised his own. Alex shook his head.
"I know the Doniger," he said. "She's not some rock hopper. She's the flagship of the MCRN's Jupiter fleet. Battleship. 250,000 tons of bad news. You ever serve on a ship that size?"
"No, I wasn't on anything bigger than a destroyer," Holden replied.
"I served on the Bandon, with the home fleet. We can't go anywhere that a ship like that can't find us. She's got four main engines, each one bigger than our whole ship. She's designed for long periods at high G with every sailor on board juiced to the gills. We can't run, sir. And even if we did, her sensor package could track a golf ball and hit it with a torpedo from half the solar system away."
"Oh, fuck that, sir," Amos said, standing up. "These Martian needle dicks blew up the Cant. I say run. At least make it hard for them."
Naomi put one hand on Amos's forearm, and the big mechanic paused, shook his head, and sat down. The galley was silent. Holden wondered if McDowell had ever had to make a call like this, and what the old man would have done.
"Jim, this is your decision," she said, but her eyes were hard.
"No. What you are going to do is get the remaining four members of your crew to safety. And that's all." Holden nodded and tapped his fingers against his lips.
"P&K doesn't have our back on this one. We probably can't get away. But I don't want to disappear either," Holden said. And then, "I think we go, but we don't go quietly. Why don't we go disobey the spirit of an order?"
Naomi finished working on the comm panel, her hair now floating around her like a black cloud in the zero-G.
"Okay, Jim, I'm dumping every watt into the comm array. They'll be getting this loud and clear all the way out to Titania," she said.
Holden reached up to run one hand through his sweat-plastered hair. In the null gravity, that just made it stick straight out in every direction. He zipped up his flight suit and pressed the record button.
"This is James Holden, formerly of the Canterbury, now on the shuttle Knight. We are cooperating with an investigation into who destroyed the Canterbury, and as part of that cooperation, are agreeing to be taken aboard your ship, the MCRN Doniger. We hope that this cooperation means that we will not be held prisoner or harmed. Any such action would only serve to reinforce the idea that the Canterbury was destroyed by a Martian vessel."
James Holden out. Holden leaned back.
"Naomi, send that out broadband."
"That's a dirty trick, boss," said Alex. "Pretty hard to disappear us now.
I believe in the ideal of the transparent society, Mr. Kamal," said Holden.
Alex grinned, pushed off, and floated down the gangway. Naomi tapped the comm panel, making a small, satisfied sound in the back of her throat.
Naomi, Holden said. She turned, her hair waving lazily, like they were both drowning. If this goes badly, I need you to throw you to the wolves, she said. Blame everything on you and get the others back to Saturn Station safely.
Yeah, Holden said. Don't play the hero. She let the words hang in the air until the last of the irony leached out of them.
Hadn't crossed my mind, sir, she said.
Knight, this is Captain Teresa Yao of the MCRN Doniger, said the severe-looking woman on the comm screen. Message received. Please refrain from further general broadcasts. My navigator will be sending course information shortly. Follow that course exactly. Yao out.
Alex laughed. I think you pissed her off, he said. Got the course info. They'll be picking us up in 13 days. Give her time to really stew on it.
13 days before I'm clapped in irons and have needles shoved under my fingernails,
Holden sighed, leaning back in his couch.
Well, best begin our flight toward imprisonment and torture. You may lock in the transmitted course, Mr. Kamal.
Roger that, Cap.
Huh, said Alex. A problem?
Well, the Knight just did her pre-burn sweep for collision objects, Alex said. And we have 6 belt objects on an intercept course.
Belt objects?
Fast contacts with no transponder signal, Alex replied. Ships, but flying dark. They'll catch us just about 2 days before the Doniger does.
Holden pulled up the display. 6 small signatures. Yellow-orange shifting toward red. Heavy burn.
Well, Holden said to the screen. And who the hell are you?
Chapter 8. Miller. Aggression against the belt is what Earth and Mars survive on. Our weakness is their strength, the masked woman said from Miller's terminal screen. The split circle of the OPA draped behind her like something painted on a sheet. Don't be afraid of them. Their only power is your fear.
Well, that and 100 or so gunships, Havelock said.
From what I hear, Miller said, if you clap your hands and say you believe, they can't shoot you.
Have to try that sometime.
We must rise up, the woman said, her voice growing shrill. We have to take our destiny before it is taken from us. Remember the Canterbury.
Miller shut the viewer down and leaned back in his chair.
The station was at its change of shift surge. Voices raised one over the other as the previous round of cops brought the incoming ones up to speed. The smell of fresh coffee competed with cigarette smoke.
There's maybe a dozen like her, Havelock said, nodding toward the dead terminal screen. She's my favorite, though. There's sometimes I swear she's actually foaming at the mouth.
How many more files? Miller asked, and his partner shrugged.
200, 300,
Havelock said, and took a drag on his cigarette. He'd started smoking again.
Every few hours there's a new one. They aren't coming from one place. Sometimes they're broadcast on the radio, sometimes the files show up on public partitions. Orlan found some guys at a portside bar passing out those little VR squids like they were pamphlets.
She bust them?
No,
Havelock said, as if it was no big deal. A week had passed since James Holden, self-appointed martyr, had proudly announced that he and his crew were going to go talk to someone from the Martian Navy instead of just slinging shit and implications. The footage of the Canterbury's death was everywhere. Debates raging over every frame. The log files that documented the incident were perfectly legitimate, or they were obviously doctored.
The torpedoes that had slaughtered the hauler were nukes or standard pirate fare that breached the drive by mistake.